25 years ago today, the 9/11 attacks, it was already underway. As we know, Flight 11 was already en route at this point, getting on its way to actually at 7:59 is when American Airlines Flight 11 was the flight that hit the first tower. It left at 7:59, so 49 minutes away from that flight. But the plans were already underway as the terrorists were already getting ready to do the awful things that they did. But throughout the morning, we're going to have interviews with some of those who were present on 9/11, not just in New York City, but at the Pentagon, as well as reaction from individuals who just were there and understand what it was like. And right now, a very special opportunity to chat with two individuals who responded to 9/11 as officers. Sal Saldarriaga and John Crosis join us. Guys, good morning.
Good morning.
Sal, I'll start with you. You were a police officer with the NYPD on 9/11, and we were just talking in the break. You actually had worked the shift until 8 o'clock a.m. You had gone home for, you know, the end of your shift, and then you started getting some phone calls and realized you had to get back down because something had happened. I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, so basically, I worked midnight shift, so I came home and I was kind of getting ready to go to bed. And my best friend, who was going into the city that day for a doctor's appointment, called me up and he told me that, you know, something had happened and a plane had hit the World Trade Center. And again, just in all honesty, you know, as New Yorkers are most of the time, I was not very interested because I'm like, oh, yeah, it's happened before. I mean, a small plane probably hit, no big deal. And I kind of like blew it off. But he called me back like about 10 minutes later. He goes, dude, you should really pay attention to this. Check it out. And at that point in time, I turned on the TV. And I actually was watching the news at the time. A couple of days prior to that, there was some incident with some Delta pilots. And this guy was the traffic reporter for the helicopter. And he was going on about how, you know, we got to put an end to these drunken pilots. Look what's happening, this and that, and all that stuff. And as he's chatting on, the pilot's trying to wave him off. And as they're waving him off, you see the camera angle turn. And basically, with the camera angle from the helicopter, from the traffic cam, you see the second plane hit. And all you hear the guy say is, goes, I don't think this is a drunk pilot incident anymore. Mm-mm. And at that point in time, you know, honestly, I didn't know what to think at that moment. We were never prepared for anything like this. To the best of my knowledge, it was the only time in history of the New York City Police Department that they had a full level one mobilization for everybody, you know, to return to command. If, you know, from wherever you were, just get back into command. And again, that's kind of what I did. I checked on my mom and my grandmother real quick. The one thing I do want to mention, because again, it's important, being in New York, such a melting pot, such a diverse place, you don't think about these things, but there was a mosque in the area where my mother lived. And drove by it every single day, never thought anything of it. You know, that day I drove by and I saw a bunch of people outside and it seemed to be like cheering and stuff. And I didn't picture it, you know, put it one and one together until afterwards. When we got to command and basically, you know, they started kind of filling us in on what's going on. They weren't even sure what was going on, to be honest with you. They started telling us that they don't know what it was. Be aware. All their protocols went into place. My actual job was to secure the precinct where I worked at the time because we had a firehouse next door to us. So we basically cordoned off the whole area. And one of the things that kind of was impressive to me is like, you know, every shift that works there, we had four shifts that were working at the time, but everybody was there at one time. So basically it was like a can of tuna overpacked, one on top of another. But basically I was there for the next 10 days.
John, that was your day off. And you were working, you said, your second job at the time, but you quickly realized that this was not going to be like any other day. Take us through what your day was like. You said that you were doing, putting up some drywall, I believe you said, at a side job. Yes. And then everything changed once you had some folks that were at the place you guys were working. Tell you what was happening.
Yes. Yeah, so I was actually a member of the New York City Correction Department at the time on September 11th, doing side work in the New York Ioneer Institute, which is located on 14th Street and 2nd Avenue in the city.
And for those who don't know, how close is that, 14th Avenue, how close is that to Ground Zero where the Twin Towers were?
15-minute walk.
15 minutes, which is what, maybe a mile, less than a mile?
Yeah.
Okay.
About that. 14th Street down to the Trade Center is about half, maybe three quarters.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So the foreman on the job site noticed that the nurses were running around packing up, you know, in a frenzy. So he knew that I was an officer in the correction department. He said to me, go out, talk to the nurses and see what's going on. So I identified myself to the nurse, and she had said to me that they were preparing for a mass casualty event, which made me ask her what happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Being inside the construction site, we didn't really have access to windows or news and or radios. So she takes us to the southernmost point in the on that particular floor, which was high up, and we have a direct line of sight to the Trade Center. The North Tower was billowing in smoke and flames, and I'm not going to tell you that I saw the second plane. I honestly didn't. But as we're taking in the sight of the North Tower in flames, the South Tower just erupted into this massive fireball. And we stood there, for, you know, shocked and stunned for a moment, at which time the nurse ran off, the foreman grabbed me, went back to the job site, and basically told all of us, pack it up, we're going to head out. So we go down to the box van, which is in the loading dock, and the short story of it is I tried to get down to the Trade Center to do my part, but I was prevented from heading up, and we ended up going to the Bronx. And then Wednesday morning, we were all, as Sal said, we were all recalled, fire, correction, sanitation. Everyone who was in the country, whether you were on vacation or not, you had to report to your command. So Thursday morning, I reported to my command and ended up working in various details around the city. You know, everyone had to be, do their part. It wasn't just the NYPD. I ended up rolling over to the NYPD subsequently, and I retired as a New York City detective.
Okay. Go ahead, Penny.
I just want to ask you a question because on the day of, nobody expected those towers to fall. But when they did, I remember seeing footage of just almost like a tidal wave of smoke and debris and people running as fast as they could to get away from that. Is that why your supervisor said no? Because you were only a mile away, and I would imagine that that was quickly coming at you.
As the towers, so what you're describing is as the towers collapsed. That wasn't the fireball.
Yes.
So as the first tower collapsed, that was what created that wall of smoke and debris and soot. And you see the people as they're heading away from the site. That's what you're describing. And then the second tower collapsed a few, you know, 20 minutes later or so. That's what created those images. Mm. I think back to that moment where these guys put me into the van against my will, but ultimately they saved my life.
Yeah.
Because by the time I would have gotten down and got involved from 14th Street would have been right around the time the first tower was coming down. So that's something I think back on all the time.
Guys, obviously you had fellow officers that ran into the flames, ran into this, that lost their lives. What was the what was it like in the days following? Where I think about this when I watch this stuff all the time, just how horrific it is when you're searching for survivors and you hear those whistles that I think that whistles are alarms that they would, that I think firefighters would wear.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So the whistles that you're describing are part of the firefighter's gear. So if they're standing still, that alarm goes off as an indicator so that they could be found. So as the firefighters are standing still, you're hearing those alarms going off. That's what those are.
And you guys, as well as many of your brethren, were trying to search for your fellow first responders.
Yes.
And just hearing these piercing sounds nonstop all over the place, because we know so many first responders were buried
in
that rubble. And I just cannot imagine what it was like for you guys, and again, your brethren, you're still in an active scene and you're having a search reveal and you know what you're looking for, right? I mean, you know the odds of finding this person alive at this point are slim, but you've still got to do your job and fight back the emotions. What was it like on Manhattan Island in the days following, just from, we see the scenes, we see it on TV, but Sal, I'll go to you for this one. The response of the people living there, the response that what we saw was people coming together and really working hard to try to locate some of these people that were buried.
So that was true. And one of the things, you know, in regards that, you know, people don't talk about much. I don't remember what I had for lunch yesterday, but I could tell you detail by detail everything that happened that day. And one of the things that always stuck with me till this day, the smell in the city was something that I cannot describe and I will never forget. It was such a putrid smell. And again, I heard all kinds of, you know, it's the asbestos, it's the jet fuel, it's all kinds of stuff. I don't know what it was, to be honest with you. Obviously, there was a lot of human remains that were being burnt alive as well. But just a couple of days ago, 25 years later, they finally let out the air report showing what that quality was like. And that's why, till this day, we still have brothers and sisters that are dying from illnesses. People talk about the day of event and how many people died at the Pentagon and the towers and stuff like that, and, you know, rightfully so. But we are losing people on a daily basis for the past 25 years, and this is continuing. But back to your question, in Manhattan, it was a very weary sight because, again, everybody did come together for once. And again, you know, anybody who's from New York knows that a lot of times these people will not give you the time of day. But everybody was kind of very, you know, helpful and resourceful and stuff like that. We were on high alert, so we secured a lot of the areas, a lot of the churches, a lot of synagogues, firehouses and places. We call them sensitive locations. Mm-hmm. We're being protected. The National Guard hit the street immediately. And that was kind of like, you know, for us, it was something to see because we never seen the National Guard on American soil in that form or fashion. And when we spoke to them, they didn't know what was going on, which is kind of very scary and, you know, nerve-wracking. And like I said, I personally believe that this is one of the worst attacks ever on American soil besides Pearl Harbor. The difference was Pearl Harbor was a military attack. This was against civilians. So we didn't know when the next attack was coming. And one of the things that we heard on our end was they were stopping cars left and right because of intelligence that was being broadcasted. And again, a lot of good intelligence, a lot of bad intelligence. But there was cars being stopped in the tunnels, on the bridges and stuff like that, potential explosives. The whole city shut down their cell phone system because they were afraid that detonation could be done through cell phone. So cell phone service was non-existent for a couple of days in the city. FEMA came down to set up their command center down at Ground Zero. And what they set up was basically cell phone communicators, which were useless. So we ended up having to rely, believe it or not, on ham radio operators who came down to the site. And those are the guys that coordinate a lot of people getting off the island in Manhattan, especially on by Battery Park, to get people and command with the regular boats owners who are there, ferrying people to Staten Island, to Jersey, to Brooklyn, to other parts, to get them off the island as safely as possible.
You both continue to work. This cause is so close to your heart, the 1013 Club. But when you mentioned just the quality, how bad it was, in 2019, the U.S. Senate passed a bill ensuring that the fund to compensate victims never runs out of money and that first responders won't have to return to Congress to plead for more funding. Is it, what do you see in terms of, because I see a lot of, we saw a lot of very sick first responders, heroes, that it looked like they really had to work hard to get money to cover the cost of their medical issues. When you see that, you know, that's what the Senate passed, from your perspective, is that enough money to impact the lives of those that gave their life?
Absolutely not. It's not enough. And they, despite our unions and stuff, we're hearing a lot of stuff that they want to stop this as quickly as possible. One of the things that our club faces on a regular basis is that those members who are affected by this, most of them have to go back to New York to get treatment because they cannot get treatment down here. And that is one of those things that, you know, you put your life on the line. You know, you do this out of the passion, out of, you know, but we don't take care of these people at all. And like I said, a lot of these guys, you know, we've literally helped some of these guys. We've had local pilots associations here ferry a lot of our members to New York to get treatment, and their families sometimes, because some of them were terminal. And so this was like the last time they could see them, especially during COVID. So again, you know, it's just one of those things that I don't think it's ever going to be enough, to be honest with you. And like I said, yes, it's 25 years ago, but like I said, people are still – I personally had three coworkers from my command that just passed away the last month.
John and Sal, I know you guys have a busy day, but thank you for spending a few moments here with us to share your experiences. And thank you so much for not just what you did that day, not just what you did in the following days, but what you continue to do for the city of New York and the United States of America. Thank you guys so much.
Okay, thank you.
Just want to share one thing with you real quick.
Yes, please.
So I have a little something I just want to share with you. So this was given to us 3 days after the thing. A local chaplain came by trying to lift our spirits. And basically the quote he gave me was, you know, when God asks, who should I send, you guys should go in. So I've had this in my wall for the past 25 years, and it's all tattered up and everything, but it's a reminder that I always take with me.